Verwandle deine Leidenschaft mit Shopify in ein Business und knack Umsatzrekorde mit dem Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Du hast richtig gehört. Der Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Der legendäre Checkout von Shopify vereinfacht das Shoppen auf deiner Website bis hin zu Social Media und überall dazwischen. Na, das ist Musik für deine Ohren. Wie du es auch drehst und wendest, mit Shopify kannst du zu einem echten Hit werden. Starte deinen Test noch heute für nur einen Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/rekorde.
Welcome to the Richard Serrett Show for Wednesday, June the 18th in the year of our Lord 2025. So picture this, June 13th, 2025. A day that reshapes the Middle East. Israel's Operation Rising Lion strikes like a bolt from the heavens, obliterating Iran's nuclear dreams and shattering its regime's iron grip. In a masterclass of deception, Israel didn't initially even need to cross borders. It struck from within, using pre-positioned drones and covert assets to decapitate Iran's military elite and nuclear scientists, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, Hossein Salami, and nuclear mastermind Feryadun Abbasi Devani, gone in a flash. Natanz lies in ruins, Iran's air defenses are blind, and Tehran's command structure is paralyzed, gripped by paranoia over how Israel infiltrated its core. Iran's response, a feeble drone swarm swatted away by Israel's Iron Dome. Tehran misread every signal, seemingly, dismissing Israel's 2024 assassinations of Hamas and Hezbollah leaders as flukes, underestimating Donald Trump's resolve, and banking on China's hollow promises. Now, the Islamic Republic teeters, its proxies like Hezbollah and the Houthis waver, and the region braces for fallout. Is this the dawn of stability or the spark of a wider war? We're going to dive into this seismic conflict with Ali Siadatan, who is a Middle East expert, watcher, director of education at Tafsik. We're going to unpack Israel's audacious strike, Iran's nuclear gamble, and the global shockwaves. And we'll also react to the Candace Owens show on Rumble, where Candace and co-host Ian Carroll call this the opening shot of World War III. So stay tuned for a no-holds-barred discussion. The Richard Serrett Show, back with more in a moment. Facta non verba.
I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
We must not allow ourselves to be intimidated. Our task is not only to win the battle, but to win the war.
We're not in Kansas anymore.
Take a look at this country through her eyes if you really want to see something. You'll see the whole parade of what man's carved out for himself after centuries of fighting.
You're out of order! You're out of order! The whole trial is out of order!
You have meddled with the primal forces of nature! And you will atone!
Seeking truth and justice in a battleground of deception and corruption. This is The Richard Serrett Show.
Welcome back, Ali Siadatan, Director of Education at Tafsik and a Middle East expert. Ali, welcome back. How are you?
Fine, thank you, Richard. Thank you for having me.
So let's begin with how Israel orchestrated this. Years of covert infiltration to pre-positioned strike assets inside Iran, bypassing its security apparatus. I mean, how were they able to do this?
Well, at the time of the revolution, there were 80,000 Jews that lived in Iran. Some estimates are 100,000. It was the largest Jewish community of the Middle East going back to over 2,300 years. The tomb of Mordecai and Esther are still there. And when the 1979 revolution happened, most Jews, there's about 9,000 left, because they're highly persecuted, left and went either to Israel or to Los Angeles in California. And the ones that went to Israel then procreated there. And I think the number is around 400,000 Iranian Jews in Israel. The defense minister under Ehud Barak, Shaul Mofaz, was Iranian. He was 6 years old when they moved. He spoke perfect Persian. So there are a lot of Iranian Jews to draw from, that who can blend in completely, speak the language as native speakers. But more than that, they have the cultural mannerisms down. They're Iranian Jews. So that's one thing that makes it very easy. The border is huge. It's very porous. You can get in and out easily. There's an entire contraband system set up at the border that you can utilize for people to be brought in and out and for goods to be brought in and out. There's kind of a black market economy, and the government lets it happen because they want people to have some measure of freedom. Whiskey, vodka, things like this have to come through the border. And as far as when did Israel enter to set up, today Israel released a lot of details about the mission, and it said that it says immediately after Israel launched a sweeping campaign across Tehran and other strategic areas, hitting missile structures. The operation had been years in preparation. Mossad sleeper cells embedded in Iran since as early as 2007 had smuggled hundreds of drones and military equipment into the country using commercial trucks. These assets remained dormant until activated in the hours before the operation.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about psychological warfare. Things like, you know, leaking false diplomatic signals. You know, at a certain point, it looked like U.S. President Donald Trump and Bibi Netanyahu were sort of at loggerheads, that they were, not getting along. As an example, we have, this psychological warfare lulling Tehran into complacency before June 13th. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yes. So the Iranians fancy themselves as great negotiators and masters of psychological warfare themselves. This time they were outwitted by two people, one an opponent that had been observing them under the microscope for decades. Netanyahu had made it the mission of his life to stop the nuclear program of Iran. It had really struck a deep chord with him since 2005 when Ahmadinejad, president, declared the destruction of Israel as a priority of the regime. And then, the art of the deal, I guess, the President Trump in his 70s has gone through a few deal making himself. And so I guess they read the room well, which was that these guys are a little bit arrogant and they think they understand their enemies. They figured it out. You know, that America doesn't have the stomach for a real war. Israel is too afraid to go alone and will be held back by the states. Trump has been elected by isolationists and people who are saying America first, and we don't want a war in the Middle East. So they put it all together, and they felt confident that there was going to be no war, and therefore they could draw a line in negotiations, which was around enrichment, and at the same time do their usual song and dance of dragging things along. They also relied on their usual wedge they like to put between Europe and America, and play one against the other. But none of it worked. Trump said, no, this is going to be a 60-day thing. I'm not going to let you drag it on. Europe completely sided with the United States because for different reasons. I mean, first, it felt the danger itself because the ballistic missiles can reach Europe and you don't want nuclear warheads on those things. Europe has its own Islamist problems right now. They're aware of that. And then Macron, he went and saw Trump, and when he came out, he spoke against the nuclear program of Iran. I realized that the deal is over Lebanon and Syria because the France holds the pen over Lebanon in the Security Council and has now received access to a very good port in Syria that will run for the Syrian government at great profit. So the Western alliance saw an opportunity to weaken Russian presence in Lebanon and Syria. And France moved in as a representative of that. And I think that in exchange for influence in Lebanon and Syria, it agreed with the United States on its Iran policy or Trump's administration. So it fell in line. So Europe and America could not be wedged. The negotiations could not be dragged on. And the very red line that the Supreme Leader put his foot on, saying that enrichment is the right of Iran, and that the Islamic Republic has its own politics and policy and will not be dictated to, gave Trump the very excuse he needed and say, no, that's a red line for me too, to be able to make the case within the Republican Party, within the sections that didn't want to go to war, and say, look, guys, I tried the deal, but as long as they can enrich, there's no point in making a deal. So naturally, all the venues suddenly closed as though their time was up.
So let me jump ahead. I want to talk about Iran's nuclear ambitions and some more about their strategic miscalculations. How close was Iran to weaponizing its nuclear program before Israel's strike? And what evidence justified Israel's urgency?
That's a very good question, because very reliable sources, and I suspect that if this is true, then it will officially be released after the war, said that basically the intelligence services discovered that they were, right now as we speak, in the process of making 6 bombs. They have war gamed it that they need 4. If Israel takes 3 out, they will then have 1 to throw on Israel. So, and it's a big country. And they were making a whole slew of new ballistic missiles with all of it, with the intention of immediately making and firing it on Israel as part of this October 7th war. It had arrived, the apocalyptic battle they wanted. And when Israel got wind of that, it decided to preemptively disrupt it and launch the attack. That is the story that has come out from several different sources. And minutes ago, the Wall Street Journal just put out another piece of news saying that intelligence has come in that even right now they're assembling a bomb. And we see the British Navy has moved into position. And if whether it's true or not, the Wall Street Journal report, it definitely gives Trump a reason to go in. That's the red line that brings America in. But as far as Israel, that's what we've now gotten, that they were making 6 bombs, and that's why Israel went in to disrupt it.
Can Iran rebuild its nuclear expertise after losing scientists like Abbasi Devani, given its ideologically rigid system?
No, it's not just about ideology. It's about the knowledge that those scientists had. It's not so easy to replace. The system has been pushed back tremendously, and Natanz has been destroyed. I think you mentioned that completely. Massive bombardments were happening today on Natanz, in addition to the original ones that were done. The IAEA says that the 15,000 centrifuges have been severely damaged in Natanz, but today there was more bombardment, and it looks like the United States is going to come in for the grand finale and destroy Fordo. If they don't, Israel has already a contingency plan in place to do it themselves. So in addition to the scientists, with the destruction of the installations, this program has been set back to oblivion, basically.
How did Iran's reliance on China's strategic pact and BRICS alignment blind it to Israel's preemptive intent?
I think that the way that Iran saw the alliance with China was that it had signed a 25-year, $400 billion energy deal with China in order to not only secure energy sales — most of the oil of Iran was going to China — but to secure itself against strikes against energy, implying that if you strike Iranian energy, you're essentially striking China. But when it came to military cooperation and Security Council cover, it relied mostly on Russia. And that's why it had embedded itself into the war effort of Russia by having drone factories that are creating drones that are being used in Ukraine and sold to Russia, and by signing, even as recently as just a few months ago, a military pact with Russia. And so it's today the ambassador of Iran and Russia said that Iran will remember who was silent and who spoke out for it. So it was Russia that was the great disappointment on the military front. The Chinese did send a plane yesterday that, when they turned the GPS system off as they entered Iranian territory, it was a large cargo plane, and we suspect that it was a delivery of military equipment. They also said that they will bankroll the war they will give the line of credit that Iran needs to fight. So they're more like an economic ally, an oil shield, but it's really Russia that they counted on in this war that failed them. But that's another, as you said, strategic miscalculation. The Russians don't care if the Iranians are going down. The Russians prefer to step back and make friends with whoever is going to take over, just like the British, the French, and everybody else.
So does Operation Rising Lion curb Iran's regional influence, or does it risk igniting sectarian chaos across the Middle East in your mind?
Well, you have to trace it back to Operation Swords of Iron that destroyed the Shia Crescent, the ring of fire on Israel, the influence of Iran in the Gaza Strip with the PIG, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, which was a Iranian militia, unlike Hamas. It directly took orders from General Zahedian in Unit 2000 in Damascus, which was the first building that Israel destroyed, to kill that general who was in command of the Northern Front, which is Lebanon, and Gaza's PIJ, which prompted the 300 ballistic missiles of April of 2024 and the 180 drones from Iran. The killing of Nasrallah then prompted the second wave of ballistic missiles. He was like a mini version of the supreme leader in charge of the strongest of all the militias. And then the fall of Damascus, the humbling of the Houthis, which were more an ally, and then the militias in Iraq are laying low because they have their own native Shia population that they also serve. So first of all, the destruction of the Shia Crescent removed the importance of Iran as a regional power. There were two regional powers in the Middle East. One was the Shia extension of Iran, and the other was the Muslim Brotherhood, which controls half of Lebanon, Qatar, Turkey, and now parts of Syria. And these were the two organizations that are transnational organizations that America and the West and Russia all had deals with for regional stability. They were in charge of flow of energy and goods and regional stability in exchange that they got to rule. And the Shia Crescent falling made it that no longer Iran can provide regional stability. It's no longer there. So the Muslim Brotherhood is filling the gap with Turkey and Qatar, and then America is bringing Saudi Arabia and UAE to balance it. And Russia is being replaced by France and America itself. When it comes to Iran, the great powers could see that the currency is all but collapsed. The economy can't kickstart. It's gone beyond the point of no return. There's a highly ideological apocalyptic cult that will not make a deal that's rational, so that it can actually join the IMEC, the India Middle East Economic Corridor. It can join the fourth economic industrial revolution that Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and UAE have bought into as manufacturing hubs. It has a population base that hates it. About 80% of the population is against the government, and it can't essentially function. So the great powers are like, well, the Shia Crescent has fallen, and they can manage this very important geopolitical area that is a bridge between East Asia and the Middle East and the custodian of massive energy. So I think that basically from the outside, everyone was seeing the same thing, that this is now a dysfunctional government, and the policy of gradual constrictivism fell in, where they were now being slowly, so that you don't kind of like spook the crazy jihadi portion of their thinking, you are slowly being squeezed under Trump. A very strategic sanctions against energy banking and energy were put in. He slowly cornered them. And so to the short of the answer is that the military victory of Israel against the Shia Crescent and now Iran's interior changed the political calculus of global powers. At first, they were constantly afraid of all the things that could go wrong. And then they suddenly saw all the opportunity that existed. The Russia, China, North Korea bloc was tremendously being weakened by losing a tremendous ally. And their custodianship in the Middle East being weakened had, you know, weakened Russia there as well, and given opportunity for allies of the West to move in. So what appeared to be possibly chaos became filled with opportunity. And the way that Israel has been able to conduct itself in Iran with such tactical precision, decapitating, it becomes apparent that the war can be won, like in Lebanon, with minimal damage and with minimal chaos. So no, I think that so far so good. The final and only question that's left to truly answer what you asked is, what's going to happen in Iran if the regime falls? How much chaos will come? That will be the ultimate test of whether the transition has been relatively stable in a very unstable region.
Du, wegen der Party am Wochenende. Ich glaube, ich krieg eine Erkältung.
Oh, dann nimm frühzeitig Immopred N.
Ich hab doch nur erste Anzeichen.
Eben, den Kaffee trinkst du ja auch, bevor er kalt ist, oder?
Ja, stimmt.
Immopred N kann bei Beginn der Erkältung die Erkältungsabwehr stärken, Erkältungserreger bekämpfen und so den Verlauf mildern.
Wenn Erkältung entsteht, Immopred.
Jetzt rezeptfrei in deiner Apotheke kaufen. Mehr Infos auf immopred.de. Zu Risiken und Nebenwirkungen lesen Sie die Packungsbeilage und fragen Sie Ihre Ärztin, Ihren Arzt oder in Ihrer Apotheke.
Der Insolvenzantrag ist gestellt. Und plötzlich läuft alles im Eiltempo. Für unsere Protagonistin beginnt jetzt die härteste Phase. In Folge 4 unserer Serie Endstation Insolvenz zeigen wir, warum Offenheit zur wichtigsten Währung wird, weshalb ein Insolvenzverwalter kein Gegner ist und wie sich ein Betrieb stabilisiert oder geordnet abgewickelt wird. Im Podcast-Kanal Gute Geschäfte von Kreditreform. Überall, wo es Podcasts gibt.
We always recommend Shopify. It took us from an idea to a real business. We got set up, I think, in less than a day. With very little effort, we could just focus on the supply chains and the product development. Shopify gives us the ability to customize without the complexity. We can change something without introducing fragility or having to pay a developer. We're Thirsty Turtle, and we leveled up our business with Shopify.
Start your free trial at shopify.com/au.
So as we speak, U.S. President Donald Trump has demanded the IRGC surrender. We have the Supreme Leader, Ali Khamenei, is underground someplace, I think in a suburb of Tehran with his family. Yes. He's handed control over to the latest IRGC commander, one of the few, I guess, remaining alive.
Right.
And the, you know, the Israelis have complete a free pass over Iranian airspace. Right. I mean, should we be anticipating the imminent arrival of the crown prince of Iran from the United States back into Iran anytime soon? Is it too soon to start thinking along those lines?
Well, I mean, the things are progressing very fast. So I think that you know, this, but we it's hard to predict how it's going to progress from here. But wherever direction it's going to go, it's going to happen fairly fast. So today, the Crown Prince put out a video saying that he was ready to assume transitional authority and that he had a plan in place first to get rid of the regime. And second, with the moment the regime falls, once his transition government is formed, he has a plan for the transition and reconstruction, which is something that involves essentially all the opposition figures and a political body being set up that will decide, that will draft different forms of government and will lead to a referendum where people will choose through referendum which form of government they want, and he will only be the leader for the 1 or 2 years that the transition is going to take, with the constitution of 1979 being reinstated so that there's law and order. So he's put his hat in the ring and he sent a signal. Because of the events that led to the revolution in the 20th century, which were around decolonization, I guess, you know, with India, with Israel, with all these countries, the idea is that the Shah, by his enemies, saw him as too much of a dependent on the U.S. He wasn't a puppet, but he was the closest ally of America other than Israel. And so there's a sensitivity in culture that another guy from the United States gets in a plane and comes after perhaps America itself bombs Fordo or you know, gets involved militarily. It's again got that aura of one more time, you know, the United States was the bringer of power, the same way that Khomeini flew in with Air France. At least he had the distinct Islamist character where, and Carter gave him $150 million. So there is an understanding, on one hand, that you need global, you know, support. On the other hand, what has to happen is that people have to go into the streets in masses and masses, like we're talking millions of people, and ask for him by name. Like that must become the cry that you hear from the streets of Tehran and Shiraz and Isfahan and the cities of Iran, that they're chanting for him. Now it makes sense for him to go in and implement his transition plan. And so he's saying the opposition and people within the regime are already calling him. That's what he said in this video, that there's massive defection happening in the regime and that he's receiving phone calls of people pledging allegiance to him, because he said that if people turned against the regime who were part of it, as long as they had not committed human rights atrocities, they would get a pass. In exchange for the service of coup d'etat, essentially. So that's one possibility with him. But it has to be something that's organically from the entrails of the people. But he's put his hat in the game today.
I want to play some clips here from Candace Owens, a very popular program on Rumble and YouTube and a podcast with Ian Carroll, her co-host last night. She's just back from maternity leave, and the title of the show, I'm Back Just in Time for World War III. Let me first share this on the screen, if I can do this. Here we go.
We obviously have been discussing Israel, the propaganda that's happening, and it's looking like we may be going to war, which either I had a crystal ball, you had a crystal ball, could see into the future, or this has been the most obvious and the most planned war in the history.
And we're not the only
wars.
Ones. A lot of people saw it coming. Like, it was clearly the agenda.
All right. Were you able to hear that, to see that? Okay. So, World War III, this is obviously, you know, been in the works for years. Well, I don't think anyone disputes that this, the Israelis have admitted Operation Rising Lion was in the works. You mentioned they were started infiltrating their assets into Iran since 2007. This has been Bibi Netanyahu's main focus for decades, is stopping, and Donald Trump, his entire first term with all of the sanctions, stopping Iran from getting the bomb. So hardly a surprise there. World War III, the concern that this is going to escalate, World War III, and that the United States is going to get involved. Your thoughts?
No, it's not going to be a World War III, because Russia and China are not going to go to war over Iran. Russia's got its hands full in Ukraine, and China's tremendous economic issues that it's dealing with. Its main focus is the tariff war and Taiwan at this point, not going to war. Could this plant the seeds of future wars where now we're seeing, you know, these power blocks that are very much different worldview emerging? That's possible. I mean, we could see future wars being laid, the foundation of future wars maybe. So we may eventually head to World War III, but not right now. But as far as the Israel and all that, you have to understand that there's a problem in the West. I was on a show last night talking about this, that there's a problem in the West about not understanding theocracy, because in a theocracy, because there's democracy, there's kingdoms, dictatorships, but theocracies are governmental systems where the mosque is the state. So it's the very opposite of the separation of church and state. It's by design, the mosque is the state. So in the Constitution of the Islamic Republic, Article 5 says the supreme leader is the representative of God, or the 12th imam, until his appearing. That's in the Constitution. That's who he is. People are brought to court and judged on that article because the protesters, for instance, refuse to accept his decision on who won the election. And the next day when they come in the street, they're charged with sedition because they go against the representative of the 12th imam. The Constitution describes the IRGC as the ideological army whose job is to propagate the law of Allah through the world. That's what it says in the Constitution. And it quotes the Quran as supporting, like, scripture. And it goes on and on and on. So it presents the leader as the supreme leader, as the leader of the ummah, the Islamic community, not the people, not the millat, but the ummat. That's the Persian, the plural. And he behaves that way. He constantly talks and says, this is what's good for Islam. This is, Khomeini also said that Islam was against nationalism. So when you've got this kind of, you know, religious theocracy that then decides in its laws and foreign policy that the appearing of the 12th Imam is contingent on the removal of Israel. You know, you mentioned the people that were killed by Israel in this operation. One of the first people that was killed in the first couple of hours was Commander General Mohsen Bagheri. And Bagheri was the chief of staff. And he took, I don't know, it looks like 10, 15, maybe more, 20,000 troops to Jamkaran near Tehran, where the 12th Imam is to offer his sermons when he arrives. It's a giant place. They wrote on the ground in big, in Hebrew and in Farsi, so that a drone could read it, that Israel must be erased off the face of the earth. And then he made a speech casting the IRGC as the army of the 12th Imam in waiting, that once they remove Israel and then he arrives, then he explained that they will take on the forces of international arrogance led by the United States. So obviously Israel wants to, you know, destroy this. And there was some debate whether they're actually going to ever act on this crazy ideology. I mean, that was one of the things that held people back from actually believing it until the 300 ballistic missiles were thrown in April, because there is no land dispute with Iran and Israel. There is no economic gain. You know, people go to war for resources, like maybe arguably Russia and Ukraine. But there's no resources here to be had by this action and no territorial. So why do they do it? Well, religion is the only answer. Therefore, so these guys actually believe in it and they're going to act on it. So if for Israel, it's like, well, am I going to let them have, you know, a massive regional army, great commanders, a nuclear bomb, and tens of thousands of ballistic missiles, and who knows what else from the Chinese and the Russians, before I defend myself? Or do I disrupt this process when such an enemy has put me on the bullseye of its eschatological plans? So Israel had no choice but to go. And the idea is it's trying to convince the world that these guys were targeting Western civilization beyond Israel. And today the Chancellor of Germany said that Israel is doing the West's dirty work. He said Israel is doing our dirty work. So,
right.
So it's recognized now that it is the free world against a dark theocracy. And that's why everyone's so hell-bent on the fact that one guy who believes he's the representative of God by constitution can have his button on a nuclear bomb.
Right, right. And I think according to this prophecy, the return of the 12th Imam must be preceded by the world being bathed in blood, right?
There are different schools. They have different schools within themselves as to how. One group school believes that. That's called the Hojatiye. The school that's in power mainly focuses on the destruction of Israel.
Okay. Let me grab here another clip from Candace Owens. And let's see here.
If anyone's dragging anybody in war, it's not Israel sitting there living its life. It's the ideological expansionist Shia caliphate imperialism that wants to destroy it, that's forcing Israel to get off its, you know, ambitions to be a tech power and live life, having to go to Israel that wants to disrupt its life to go to war with the death cult. Not really.
All right. Let's hear another clip here.
It was just becoming very obvious that there was some sort of an infiltration that was happening, and they all knew what their marching orders were. Bibi Netanyahu wanted them to emotionally manipulate us to think that, oh my gosh, you cannot even question anything the state of Israel is doing because we're in this very precarious state and the Holocaust is around the corner. And it's just, it's factually not true. And we have a right to discuss what our nation is doing, what we are funding, who is being killed by this, and whether or not this relationship with Israel serves us. Has it ever served us? War in the Middle East. Give me that time where war in the Middle East, when they said, it's going to be peaceful after this. We're just going to do one more regime flip. When did that work? Tell me the last time.
And the craziest part is that they have not even changed the script from the Iraq war. It is the exact same script. They are weeks, months, just they're right around the corner from weapons of mass destruction, from nuclear weapons. Like Bibi was on the stand in U.S. Congress in 2003, giving the exact same speech about Saddam Hussein in Iraq and about how we'll overthrow him and then there's peace will sweep the region. He used some phrase like ripples of peace or something like that. Yeah, that's, you know, what, 20, 30 years later now, and, right? He's been claiming this stuff about Iran for 30 years. He's been claiming this stuff about the other nations he wanted to overthrow in the Middle East for 20 years. It's not... they didn't have very much creativity with this one.
No, and I think that's what it is. It's worked for them in the past. It obviously worked the best after 9/11, and we weren't allowed to ask any questions about that.
All right, so I'm just going to stop sharing there. So this idea that this is just, we've seen this before, we've seen the movie before, going back to Iraq. And I mean, you know, a fair comment in that we were all, not all of us, but many people were deceived by this weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. We know that was a fabrication. They're saying that this is basically the same, this is Bibi Netanyahu falsely crying wolf yet again, going back to, you know, this idea that it's not about the nukes, Iran doesn't have nukes, and so forth. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of ideas that she brought up that were kind of then pushed together to form a narrative. But when you open up each one of those ideas, they lead you to different places. So she talked about 9/11. At the beginning, after 9/11, the fact that it was an Islamist, you know, war was very clear to everybody. But somehow over the years, the Islamist movement was able to shield itself in some sort of an oppressed narrative, where instead of the world seeing the danger of organizations like the Muslim Brotherhood or the Shia, you know, caliphate as a continuation of what led to 9/11 and that, well, the Taliban, these are dangerous things, ideas, somehow we start to come into a sleep. And the Marxist perspective that we're dealing with an oppressed people, like when Khomeini, the founder of the Revolution of Iran, was a very dark man, was in France, some of the French philosophers like Foucault and Simone Beauvoir were casting him as the people's person against imperialism. And it's like, wait, he's not against, he's for Islam. And his version of it is he's a cleric, he's a priest, he's a rabbi. I mean, that's what he is. So this is strange, this lack, this wall that exists in the West around, I say that Islamists hide in the blind spot of the secular mind. I can't put my finger on it, but there's some sort of a blockage in the Western mind about understanding the prevalence of religion and how it translates to politics. So first of all, what these guys believe in is very dangerous to everyone in the region. And there's something real that's being confronted. There's no conspiracy there. It's just people were lulled into this Marxist sleep of seeing Islam through the windows of Marxism to the left.
What about the idea, and this is a fair comment, that you know, regime change, this idea of regime change has never worked well for anyone.
Yeah, that's, I think, Saudi Arabia, when Trump was recently in Saudi Arabia, he made a speech, I don't know if you saw it, and he took a shot both at the neocons and at the democratic NGO system of Soros. He said, look, regime change hasn't worked. And he pointed to Iraq, this idea that you kind of bring democracy and drop it into, you know, the Arab world. And he said that the system of, you know, NGOs and influencing the world through it hasn't worked either. But what has worked is Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and UAE, where he said they're three prosperous and stable nations because they're based on their own native structure and native power. And so that is the philosophy being brought to Iran this time around under Trump, which is nationalism, essentially, which is let each nation, you know, build itself. So that's why Trump was so reluctant to follow Netanyahu. It was partly theater, but partly not. I think that Trump would have been able to live with a deal if they had agreed to not enrich uranium. I think he would have agreed to the deal. I mean, that was the condition he put it forward. Also, his other condition that wasn't mentioned too much publicly was that he wanted to do business with Iran. He wanted, if America was going to use political capital and money to negotiate, he didn't want the Russians, the Chinese, and the Europeans to be the benefactors of his negotiations. He wanted American business to come in, and the Supreme Leader said that was going to be fine. He said, America can come and do business here all they want. So he would have taken those deals because he believed in this idea of allowing the nations to build from within. And he says, you know, he wants Iran to be rich. It's got resources. It's got talent. He believes in all of those things are true. But these guys are ideological. They don't care about those arguments. They have their own agenda. They just want to get past the hump.
Right.
And Trump was like, I'm not going to let you pass the hump. If you're not going to join the world order and play ball with the rest of us, your one strange idea of this apocalypse is not going to set the, you know, is not going to decide for the rest of what's going on. So these are very specific cases. Each is different. And we're now past the neocon and the NGO system based on the Saudi Arabia speech. And we've now turned the page towards nationalism. So,
okay, very quickly, because I do want to get back to one, at least one more clip here. And that is that if Trump, let's say, caves and deploys U.S. forces, remember, you know, George W. Bush had a huge domestic agenda. He was going to revamp Social Security and so forth. He was going to be the domestic president. That all got side railed by 9/11. It defines his presidency, right? Iraq. Right. Iraq defines his presidency. There is great concern within MAGA that Donald Trump is going to follow suit and the same thing, get American boots on the ground, American sons and daughters dying in Iran, and another forever war that will totally destroy the promise of MAGA and the Trump presidency. Just a quick thought on that before we get back to Candace.
Yeah, I think that that's not going to happen because his prize is the economic bill that he put forward. That is what's going to define his presidency. That's what he wants. He wants all of this to go away. He wants Ukraine and Iran to go away so that he can, and Gaza, so he can focus on his economic plans. The idea of letting Israel to go in there, the political calculus is determining how well Israel does. If Israel right now had gone in there and gotten stuck and could get anything done, then Trump would be pulling back on them and saying, you know, I think we're going to have to make a deal. But now that Israel has been so quickly victorious, like in Lebanon, it's changed the political calculus. America feels more confident that, hey, this is possible. With minimal effort, we can topple these guys and get the deal we need without any boots on the ground, using aerial and bombardment. So I think that the goal of Israel and America is right now to push them into a corner, disarm them completely, and let the people of Iran rise to finish them off, or if they don't rise, make a deal with whoever is in power. It's not about going into a war or putting any boots on the ground.
All right. Another clip here from Candace and her co-host, Ian Carroll. Let's have a listen.
So before the whole war kicked off with, you know, the preemptive strike from Israel.
Yeah, just to be clear, they're either attacked or they attack preemptively, but they're never wrong, right?
No, they are definitely defending themselves. Defending and themselves, they clearly have the right to attack, defend themselves. Even when they attack, they're defending themselves. Let's be clear. But we were in the process of having negotiations. It was literally the day before peace talks and deproliferation agreements with Trump, where the U.S. was going to meet with Iranians to talk about their nuclear program and talk about the tensions and talk about the whole war situation in the Middle East and theoretically move towards peace and de-escalation. And Iran seemed to think that we were acting in good faith. And presumably, Trump and our team seemed to think that they were acting in good faith. And then Israel launches this attack, this preemptive strike on Iran, and Trump comes out and, like, the U.S. position is like, we had no idea. We knew nothing about it. Just like with the strike in Ukraine. We didn't know. We had nothing to do with this. This was not us. Even though I have some questions there, too. Mm-hmm. And then Israel just comes out and is like, actually, psych. The U.S. was in on it, and Trump was just tricking the Iran, and they were, like, totally fooling Iran to just get them all into a state of, like, calm and not suspecting. And it's like, bro, what are you doing? Like, so if Israel's lying and the U.S. didn't know and Israel just played this whole weird game on us, that's so messed up. That is beyond messed up.
Also, because we give them billions of dollars every year.
Should be condemned. They should be cut off.
They should be cutting you off financially.
But if they're telling the truth, that is also super messed up. The blowback of that in the future is completely unknown. Because next time, suppose it's nuclear Russia or suppose it's nuclear North Korea that we're trying to negotiate with next time, how seriously are they going to take our reaching out to want to de-escalate something when this is what happened to Iran?
All right. So let's focus about the deception. We talked about the deception earlier, this diplomatic deception. I mean, is there going to be blowback? Iran is the adversary here. How do you feel about this deception? Was Iran ready to go to the table yet again in good faith, as Ian Carroll was saying, or was this just another delay tactic by Iran?
It was a delay tactic. They were hoping to push it to the midterms because that's what worked for them last time with Trump. They waited till the midterms. The Supreme Leader said there shall neither be peace nor war, but strategic patience. And their gamble worked. The Democrats took Congress, and then they waited, and the Democrats took the presidency, and then they launched the first Gaza war because they know that the progressives are more tolerant of radical Islam. So they were going along with the same playbook. Once the Trump kind of put pressure on them and saying, no, I'm not going to let you drag it, they started to put a lot of obstacles on the content of the deal, basically saying, okay, we'll agree to the JCPOA and we'll surrender the uranium that we've already enriched, which was about 300 kilograms. But beyond that, you know what? We gave Obama 3.76% enrichment. We'll give you 3.25. Like this, you can say you took us down by 0.5%. And Trump then kind of, I think, considered that, at least shopped it around, because he wanted to know what his, you know, entourage felt about that. And he did send Witkoff. Now, did he send Witkoff because he wasn't serious at all? And so he thought, I'll just send an unexperienced new realtor from New York to negotiate with one of the most powerful dictators in the world over a complex nuclear file? Or did he send Witkoff to signal that I'm sending a businessman rather than a hawk like Rubio because I want to make a deal? I'm sending you a businessman saying, let's make a deal. So I think Trump really did decide that he's going to play both. He's going to have the military option through Israel, and he's going to go for a deal which totally does the same thing as the military option, which means it removes the nuclear thing out of their hands. But he wasn't going to allow himself to be dragged along and tricked, because he had noticed how tricky they had been in the past. And so he had learned. And so he was, okay, if you let go of all uranium enrichment, that's the only way we can know. Now, there's lots of other sites that they've created around the country where they are secretly doing this. And there's enough information out, even the public, about those, that I think Trump was aware of that. And so I think that there was a lot of mistrust on his part when it comes to a deal. But he was willing to live with it, because as long as under his watch it was taken care of, he didn't care about what other presidents had to deal with. But he couldn't even get that deal. So he had to then agree with option plan B, which was to follow Israel into war. And the fact that Israel was so willing to go made it easier for America not to be involved in that part and let it happen. But was it some sort of a charade where at the beginning they'd already decided that we're never going to make a deal, and they were just lulling them into some weird sense in order to satisfy internal politics in the States? It was just an excuse of checking the boxes. The only way that would be true is, as I said at the beginning, if the global powers had felt that the Shia Crescent's collapse and the chaos in the country made it impossible for this government to provide stability over the IMEC region, which is very important for America, Democrats and Republicans. They want to isolate China. That's the top foreign policy, and move factories to India and then move it from Mumbai to the port of Haifa to Berlin to the world. This is the India-Middle East economic corridor that Biden put into place and Trump is building. That's what the deal with Qatar and Saudi Arabia and UAE is partly about. And you can't have ballistic missiles and nuclear stuff flying over your IMEC when you're trying to, you know, it's the world economy and not saying China. So I think the two of the people you showed me, the Condoleezza Owens and her psychic. Candace and Ian. And I don't know why I have this problem name sometimes. Candace and Ian have a very kind of partly conspirational, but also partly kind of personal way of looking at it, like they're America. They're not understanding that America is a global power that has to deal with many jurisdictions as part of a global order that involves, you know, the G7, Russia, China, and all of these countries sometimes have common concerns when it comes to the movement of energy and goods to feed the billions of people they have to manage for whatever nefarious purpose they have in mind. But at least they got to make sure that, you know, people are functioning. And you can't have a rogue state in the middle of a very big economic zone that's collapsing before your eyes and has no internal support and can't get its economy up and can't make a deal with anybody because it's so ideological. So I think a decision was made on a global level that their time is up. And I think that that's another way of looking at it. If there was any trickery, was because the decision had already been made and you didn't want to spook them into jihad or blowing up cells all around the world or blowing up Jewish community centers or blowing up the Strait of Hormuz. So you had to kind of lull them into a quiet, gradual constrictivism.
Ali, before I let you go, last question. Just give me a couple minutes here and then you're out the door. Looking ahead, best case scenario in that region, now that it looks like, assuming Iran, in fact, the regime there falls, they are replaced, there's some sort of a democracy put in place. Just paint me a picture, best case scenario for the region, including Iran, Israel, Saudi Arabia, in the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years.
Well, I mean, the best thing would be for the Crown Prince to take over because he's pro-Israel, pro-West, pro-liberal democracy, and has already agreed to sign the Cyrus Accords, which have already been drafted, which will immediately normalize relations with Israel and the IMEC and get Israeli technology to help with the water problem in Iran and have plurality of religion, freedom of everything, and democracy. So that would clearly be the best solution in an ideal world. But how is it going to go forward? Well, there's one thing to understand is that in the country right now, there's a lack of organization around political change. People are kind of shell-shocked under this sophisticated dictatorship. They're in the grips of fear. Even what's happening right now, they're not thinking about coming in the streets and protesting. They're very confused and kind of leaving the city. They don't even know what's going on. So first of all, this event is the beginning of a spark that has moved a revolutionary spirit that began in 2022 forward one stage. It's like when you eat food and then it goes from your mouth to your stomach. Right now, it's in the mouth and throat. What Israel has brought in, it's about to go in and get digested. So the next thing to look for is how much will the power structure be eroded? Are they going to kill the supreme leader? Is there going to be mass defection from the government and IRGC and army to support the people? In that case, there could be a collapse. And if people call for, you know, Reza Shah Pahlavi, then he can come. If not, maybe the regime holds and you get a surface decapitation that satisfies Israel and America. You get the removal of the nuclear facilities and enough damage to the ballistic system. And then you have another group from within that rises. The showcase changes, but not the content. And they make a deal. And maybe this group is already in place, and maybe this group already has a deal, and that's why they're not actually firing anything. And that's what, you know, for all we know. And so all America has to do is kill the supreme leader or allow Israel to do it, and then the new system emerges from within, and that is less ideal, even though they will give more reprieve to the people because, you know, they just lost a huge face. And they'll also back off the region. They'll agree to the terms, the three terms of Israel. No militias in the Middle East controlled by Iran. No nuclear weapons and limited range of ballistic missiles. And that's something Europe and America want as well. So that new group from within could agree to that. So these are the two ways it can go once the whole thing is digested. Once we have to see the extent of the erosion and damage. And two, we have to see whether it becomes a complete, you know, shift towards the people or a change from within.
Ali, thank you. I kept you longer than I anticipated. Your insights are tremendous. As always, I appreciate you hanging out and your expertise. Thank you so much.
You're most welcome, Richard. It was a pleasure to be here.
Ali Siadatan. All right, that's it for me. I'll speak with you again real soon. In the meantime, I remain unbowed, unbent, unbroken.
Schon wieder Bewerberflaute? Sie schalten Anzeige um Anzeige. Das nervt und ist doch viel zu teuer. Stopp! Raus aus der Recruiting-Spirale. Mit StepStone All Jobs bekommen Sie alle Anzeigen für ein Jahr in einem Paket zu einem fixen Preis. So sparen Sie bis zu 75% Kosten pro Bewerbung und sind jederzeit flexibel. Jetzt Termin vereinbaren auf stepstone.de/alljobs. StepStone. Einfach die richtigen Talente finden für alle Jobs.
Moin, Digga. Du sag mal, erhöht deine Krankenkasse auch?
Nee, meine Krankenkasse bleibt stabil.
Crazy, Bro. Welche ist das?
Sagte ich doch. MKK. Meine Krankenkasse.
Ey, Brudi, bist du auf Autokorrektur? Ich höre immer meine Krankenkasse.
Check's einfach selbst. www.meine-krankenkasse.de MKK. Immer für dich da. MKK. Einfach digital.